Hey everyone, how are you all doing? Thank you for coming to Production Companies 2.0, where we'll talk a bit about what it takes to start up a production company, and especially in new media. My name is Zadi Diaz, and I'm principal of Smashface Productions and executive producer of Jet Set. And we have David Prager from Revision 3 here. We have Ryan Hodson from Ryan is Hungry. We have Douglas Srine from Ask a Ninja and Beatbox Giant Productions. And we have Andrew Barron from Rocket Boom and Abbeycore. So we have a good array of people here from different angles of productions who have started shows, who are now either getting into production companies, have started it, or are really well involved. So we want to ask, first of all, how many of you guys have a production company or have started? I know that there are a lot of video bloggers here.
Whoa.
Wow.
Like
okay.
Half or more.
Nice, nice. So I think there's going to be a really good Q&A that signifies. So what we want to talk about, all of us up here are content creators. To some extent, we have started with one show and kind of gone forward and had this idea of starting a production company, especially in new media and online, and what does that take? I know that I was inspired in the beginning when I started in 2004 by Rocket Boom, because it was one of the first ones out there, one of the first shows. And so one of the questions I want to ask you, Andrew, to begin with, you started Rocket Boom and now you're going on to creating more shows. And what was the idea? How did it spark from content creator? And how did the idea spark in, like, you know, now I want to build a production company. What led you to that?
I guess I would say that most of what I was doing really was informed by blogging. And so whenever I would come up against a problem or something and I would look for the answer, I would always go back to blogging and say, well, what would you do in that scenario? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that seemed compelling to me personally was sort of the blog model that Jason Calacanis and Nick Denton had done with their Weblogs Inc. and with Gawker, and that I sort of imagined how the idea of sort of having all of these individual blogs that were niche, that suited these niche interests, would happen anyway. I mean, even if somebody didn't organize it and create it, it would just happen because people would start creating these shows. And so it just that kind of excitement and sort of the feeling that I could do it and primarily, once Rocket Boom got to a certain point, the sort of the inside of me, the desire to just be innovative and keep moving things forward and everything is probably what really pushes that desire the most. You know, Rocket Boom's been a little bit complacent over the last 6 months, you know, while we do a lot of back-end stuff and everything, and that's just really hurt. It just hurts me every day waking up not being able to take the next step forward. So that kind of drive, I think, is what's really pushed me in that direction.
See, that's really interesting because a lot of, you know, starting out, Ryan, you started out in 2004 as an independent video blogger, just kind of documenting your life. And now you've kind of gone forward to creating a show in San Francisco, right? Correct? That's called... Well, tell us a little bit about that.
So, I started, like Zadi and Andrew as well, I started video blogging in 2004, doing a personal video blog, which I still do pretty actively. And I moved to San Francisco a year ago, and my partner Jay and I started documenting just the geeks and the green scene in San Francisco, because both of those it's a hub for both of those things. So I was tired of putting interviews on my personal blog. A lot of my friends were saying, I'm so sick of seeing these interviews, but there's a group of people who wanted to see them. So we were like, let's just separate this out. We have our personal blogs. Let's do a more professional show type thing, because both Jay and I come from television backgrounds. I was an editor on a PBS show for 2 years, and so I was really, I mean, I was about, you know, doing productions, and I wanted to get back into being a producer, not just like making little snippets of my life, which I love to do and I still do, but I was like, I want to use a microphone, you know, like little things like that. Like, I want to interview people and see what's going on in the world. So that's kind of when we branched off. Like, and when you have a blog, it's not like a television network where you're like, I have to pitch this whole other show and get all this funding. It was like, let's just start another WordPress blog and put those videos there.
Right.
So we did that, and it's grown. You know, now I make my living off that blog. So
And David, you're coming from a traditional kind of background with tech TV, and Dignation is one of the shows that started with Revision 3, correct? And so what was that transition like? Like, Ryan's talking about how she was a producer on TV. Yeah. Like, what was that transition like for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I really think it's production, you know, the name of the panel is Production Companies 2.0, but it's all, also, it should, you know, you could really put in and say that it's also Production and Distribution Channels 2.0. Yeah. And so really, it's the big thing is that the barrier of entry is not really there anymore. You know, if you have a blog and you want to be able to put videos up there, the cost to do that is not very expensive at all. And also, another element is the fact that, you know, nowadays you can get relatively inexpensive software, relatively inexpensive camera equipment. So back to the question you were asking me about coming from a television background before, the roots that started Revision 3 were the fact that I work with several of my colleagues over at Tech TV creating technology-oriented programming, and when the entity that created that, the entity that was Tech TV, began to disappear, several of us knew that the barrier of entry for using stuff online and the fact that broadband is propagating, we were able to actually say, hey, we know how to do these things. We can use our own equipment that doesn't cost a lot, and we can distribute it without a traditional television network.
Right.
And that's how that got started.
And with you, Doug, you're coming from a more kind of like creative background where you're a performer, writer. And living in Los Angeles, there's so many independent filmmakers and writers that this would be a great medium for them to use. How do you deal with the step of like being a performer and then being kind of pushed into this like production company? And what was the shift, the mental shift that you had to make?
Well, it was a twofold shift because I was actually working in traditional media syndication for many, many years, and so I was very trained in that way of thinking of, you know, working with major studio syndication, especially in terms of television, and it was so finite, and I saw how hard it was for anybody to get anything out there, and then it was Keenan Ivory Wayans, and then it went for one season, and no one wanted to see it. And then I was doing very involved with live theater and live comedy in Los Angeles, and it was, you know, Kent Nichols who came to me and opened my eyes and introduced me to some things like Red versus Blue and Homestar Runner, and showed me how these people had created and these teams had created these whole worlds that countless people could enjoy, and there was very low barrier of entry for people getting involved with it. And he just encouraged me as an artist to say, hey, this is a way that you can express yourself freely without having to bow to, you know, the Hollywood model or bow to traditional media. And it wasn't to say we want to shut down communication with traditional media. I always want to keep that dialogue open, and I always want to be there for, you know, for Hollywood when they want to have that dialogue, but to say that it's not a requirement. Right. It's not a requisite. You don't have to get approval from someone else before you express yourself. Right. And that was tremendously empowering, and it has completely changed my life. I mean, now, you know, Ask an Engine Beatbox Giant, you know, has liberated me from the corporate world, and I don't have to be a paralegal anymore.
You were a paralegal? Really? Interesting. I'll note that down. Andrew, I know that you've always spoken about that, kind of like you've started it yourself. When you began, did you look at other people, like creating the infrastructure of a production company, did you even think of it that way of like, well, who are the people that I need to associate myself with? Who do I need? How do I start this up? What personnel? You know, did you start thinking about salaries? Like, what was the thought process behind that?
For me, luckily, over the last 2 years, we've had this intense amount of incoming, and I call it, we've got what I call a catcher's mitt, which is so much things coming in, like somebody calls and says, hey, we're coming up with a new distribution platform, we wanted to show it to you and see if you want to distribute here, or, you know, we want to do ad things, or we just want to find out things, or, I mean, people always asking to somehow collaborate or do something that... we've had so many venture capitalists come in, for instance, and then I remember like the first times they started calling, I was like, VC, what does that mean? VC, what does it stand for? I didn't even know.
Viet Cong.
And so then that's a pretty good, well, that's about what I learned. I did, it was like, oh, this is great. So then I spent quite a while like meeting with them and really getting to understand that. And I got to really understand so many of the different aspects of a business without having to commit to anything. But also, I knew that I was not a business person. I've already, from my experience, luckily enough in my life, knew that I'm just not that type of a person and that I never will be, probably. And so I knew I always need to find somebody to help. And that's been the hardest thing of all is trying to find somebody who you don't even know if they're good or bad because you're in such bad shape. You know, you can't even really assess it. But then once I found that person, about 7 months ago, from that point on until today has been an incredibly intense ride because it was the first time where I had to stop doing all of progressing in all of the ways that didn't require money or anything else. And I had to stop and say, how do you do a business? How do you set it up? Do we do VC? How do we set up a roadmap? How do we do our accounting? Get our bank account, get our trademark. All of that kind of stuff has been painful to set up because it's that time where you're not progressing, you know, and you're spending money. And then suddenly now you've got like 6 or 7 people and you're like, how am I paying for all of this? And it's really, it's been just such a huge learning experience. And the last little point I'll say on this is that I feel really, really fortunate even today to have sort of struggled through that part. Mm-hmm. Because even with Abbeycore, it's not like now that we're set on this roadmap and we've got all this money coming in, we've got to do A, B, and C and everything else, and that it's all set for the next 36 months. It's more like we still are in the opportunity, we're still in the phase of an opportunity to be able to look around and have that discussion go and to grow it still a little bit more slowly. Like even a month ago, what I was thinking has changed drastically on how to do all of this. And there's so many different ways. You know, if you, and my opinion is that like venture capital is, it's not that it's bad or anything, but any company that's got that typically, stereotypically, is a company that is not interesting to me because, at least in our space, because I kind of have a sense of what that roadmap is now. It's all laid out. It's like, okay, we've got this money. We get our ad sales going. We throw in pre-roll, mid-roll, post-roll, whatever it is. It's going to be usually like some ad or sponsorship thing, and that because the VCs are there, they usually, you know, want to sell something. And again, this is not the way all companies go, of course, even with VC, but it's just so scary to have to get into that, finally, that position where you have to commit. And I'm really still enjoying being able to take a left turn. And I think that I want to hold on to that as long as I can. Mm-hmm. And that I said that was the last point I would say, but okay, one more sentence.
Are you sure?
No, I'll just stop there.
It's
pass
okay.
It on.
You sure?
Yeah,
because actually, come back to your point, it made me think of David. You know, Revision 3 has 13 shows, and you have you were talking about before, and when we were in the green room about angel investors and how you kind of mm-hmm. like are getting into that. You're going into the next round. What can you give us real world kind of examples of how you went after these angel investors? Like how for people that haven't started a production company or are thinking about it, what do they need to do? Like what is it?
Well, you don't really necessarily need like angel investors or VCs at all. And I'm not sure if Andrew was talking about trying to avoid that because you don't want to relinquish a certain amount of control. If you go seek more money to obtain a level of growth that you might not be able to do without money, you know, you're selling the vision of your company to those investors and you're getting them to invest in what you're doing and giving you the control to do that. If you give up a certain amount of the interest in your company, you know, you can still have a controlling interest in everything that you do. So digressing a little bit, we started Revision 3 without, you know, with a little bit of our own seed money, you know, some help from our friends. And what we did is we kind of started creating a couple of the shows that we wanted to do based on our interest and based on some of the things that we used to do at Tech TV that we weren't able to do. And we were able to reach a certain level of success, which is really great to actually have a certain critical mass of people that are interested in the niche content that you provide that you can actually go monetize that by selling to sponsors that want to reach your audience. Once we had established that, we decided we might want to legitimize the company because we reached a certain level of success and we wanted to try to grow it. And in order to grow it to a certain level, what we wanted to do and bring in more of the people that we were working with before and be able to almost recreate what we had before, we thought it might be a good idea to go out and get money that would be required in order to grow at a certain level. Because if you only have a certain show that's bringing in a certain amount of money, it's self-sustained right there, and you can maybe, unless it's outrageously successful, in order to do a certain level of growth, you're either going to have to invest more of your own money if you have it, or go out and prove to the investor community that you have a vision for the productions or the company that you're doing that they can believe in, that if you're able to spend their money wisely in the direction that you want to take the company, that they'll get the returns.
Right. Do you want to add something to that?
I was just going to say, though, does anybody know of any scenario like that in our field where a venture capitalist would come in onto a production company and actually commit a substantial amount of money, especially beyond an angel round, for any model that doesn't include advertising?
Well, when we created Revision 3, it was in our mindset that we would support ourselves through sponsorship. You were talking about pre-roll, post-roll, mid-roll. A lot of us, especially in this new medium of distributing, TV on the web, are kind of we're fortunate to create it as we go along. But at the same time, you have to choose a model that is actually viable. And so for our form of sponsorship, yes, we could do pre-roll and post-roll type of things. We wanted to try to create something that was as enjoyable a user experience or viewer experience as possible. And so it doesn't have to be the way it's done, but the way we try to pride ourselves on doing it is by integrating the sponsors within the show, where we'll actually have a host of a show say, hey, we really want to thank so-and-so for supporting us, and tell their message. And we even did a focus group and asked a bunch of the people that watch some of our shows, what they thought, because we don't want to, we want to be as unintrusive as possible. We want to make our content as enjoyable as possible while still being able to sustain it and monetize it. And again, going back, we've decided that, the vast majority of that sustainability is going to be through using a sponsorship advertising model.
We definitely have found that just because there is so much unknown area, that being honest with your fan base or the people that are watching your show, of just telling them, hey, we're exploring. We're trying to figure out a way that we can keep this going and figure out a way that we can pay our bandwidth bills. So we're going to try starting a little store. We're going to try doing some advertising. We're going to try a sponsorship model. Or we might try licensing it to this person or another. And, expressing to your audience in an open dialogue to say, hey, we're gonna explore this. We don't know what's gonna work. If you open yourselves up, you won't lose fans as you explore the space. As you strive towards that viable business model, you won't lose the support of the people that are keeping you in business.
Right, and to that point, Ryan, you're kind of different from the other guys here, I guess. Guys, and that your show Ryan is Hungry is really about it's more kind of citizen journalism, more informational.
Sure.
When you talk about sustainability, how do you sustain yourself? How do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, our situation's a little bit different. I mean, we in the beginning we were thinking we weren't really thinking about making money. I mean, you're always thinking about that when you're a hardcore blogger, of course. I mean, because you have to sustain your life,
Right.
But we were we do want to be the people delivering this content to this group of, this audience who's interested in these things. Do we get local sponsors? Do we get, people in San Francisco who do green things or do geeky things that make money that can pay us? Well, we're trying to look for those things. But it's interesting because when you are a production company of two people, and you're interviewing people and you're shooting stuff and you might have a freelance gig or you might have a full-time job, it's when do you have time to be let's figure out our business model? There's not very much time for that, And so we were very fortunate to strike a deal with PodTech who is licensing our material. So they're paying us to let us have control over, like you were saying, like have control over our content. Right. And own our content.
Right.
And we put it on their site as well. So we have like a partnership going. And that's been amazing. Like that's such that, I mean, for me as an artist and a producer, being able to produce my own content and get paid to do that is like, that's a dream.
So do you think then, I mean, is the future for independent producers or, you know, have independent production companies, is it more kind of like hoping to be acquired by a podcast, or you know, is or can you be sustainable by just going after? Since it's only you have limited resources. You have, like you said, two people working in a production company. You can't really pay attention to everything.
Right.
Is the hope then to I'm just going to do a good enough show or produce a good enough product to hopefully have somebody come in and license and just buy it? Or can you?
I think it just depends on the person. Like whoever feels comfortable with what. Like some people might make stuff that's like, yeah, I want to get bought out by someone, you know? Or, I mean, for us, we like to maintain as much control over our own content as possible, which is really hard when there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of networks, like online video networks that are really hungry for this content. And it's so easy to be like, I'm just going to sign this contract because then I don't have to have a full-time job. And I think that's the difficult thing for people like us who are like just, I mean, we're slowly starting out this whole show thing where we're like, what's an LLC, you know? Like, but actually, I'm going off on a tangent a little bit, but I found it really helpful within the video blogging community to communicate with these people, mm-hmm. you know, get on an email list where you're like, do you guys have an LLC? Should I have an LLC? Like, just really, like, figuring stuff out together, because I'm not a business person either, you know, and I'm starting to, you know that, okay, I need a lawyer to look over this contract. You know, it's really, like, sustainability like that in such, like, small increments is really important for artists and creators. Like, okay, yeah, you do need a lawyer because, you know, some of you in the room might have totally gotten screwed by contracts. You've just been like, yes, I'm totally going to publish this book. And then you read it later and you're like, should have had a lawyer look at it.
Doug,
you know?
That's a good segue for you because I'm wondering what your dealings are with your
communication, you know, on just keeping that dialogue open has it saved our business because we were making, we just made a couple bad choices, a couple bad decisions, thinking that we were like, oh yeah, wow, $100, a three-figure deal, and then you realize that they actually wanted to own the entire brand or something like that, and Kent and I took an entire month off of production and just just to explore and build up a team of people that could help us. And to both interface with traditional media, interface with businesses, make sure that we don't lose our brand, make sure that we can grow and expand, and that Barb and Alan Nichols don't get screwed, or Kent Nichols' parents, who were our angel investors. Definitely keeping that dialogue open, asking other people what they were doing, how they were doing it, really saved our company. But also, once there was a certain level of success or popularity, of just taking a moment and saying, okay, wait a minute, what do I know how to do? What don't I know how to do? Let me admit what I don't know how to do, or what that I definitely don't want to be doing, and build that team and find that person or persons who want to do that.
Right. So it seems like from what you're saying and from what Andrew was saying that you have that those growing pains and that there is that kind of downtime where you need to figure it out and kind of, just concentrate on something else, concentrate on the business side. And when your resources are limited, you know, it suffers a bit.
I think it's worth it to pay a lawyer, honestly.
Absolutely.
I'm telling you, like, you're like, I have $1,000 and I need to pay rent, but you don't want to lose your brand. I mean, that's important stuff. I mean, if you have a brand, but like, you know, if you don't want someone to own your content, have someone look at that language. You know, I mean, there have been times where I'm like, yeah, a contract, you know?
Yeah.
It's like they could totally own your life if you sign that
Yeah, I mean, I spent 7 years in syndication contracts, and still some of these things that were coming at us were just so deep and had so, you know, when they're trying to define new media, it's so tricky, and they, you know, the way that they respond, you know, anything transmitted electronically, you know, or something, it's just like, really?
Huh.
Anything involving light or sound.
And, you own all that?
Yeah, and they put it in the last little sentence, and you just need somebody, just a
but
more
also,
competent
yeah.
eye.
And talking with each other, I mean, it's like, talk with other creators, talk with people who you see their show, and you're like, hey, they have a show, they make money. How'd they do that?
Right.
I mean, that's helped us so much to talk to other people.
David, I mean, being that you have been in doing this with 13 shows, I mean, you're involved. What have you come across in terms of, like, legal issues or contract negotiation that people should look out for? I mean, is there some sort of advice?
There's so many ways you can get started. I mean, half of this stuff can get started grassroots. It depends on if you already have a full-time job and you're not deciding, I'm going to start a production company, I'm going to stop everything else I do, and I'm still going to, you know, raise my kids and pay my mortgage type of thing. But, like, there's certain things that you can do where you don't need an extensive amount of help, which meaning, like, you can register your own domain names, you can encode your own video, you can put that out there. Well, I mean, once you get to a certain size and reach a certain level of success, you do need to worry about, what's my trademark? Is someone else going to come after it? I don't really think it's something that you need to worry about early on at all. You know, with our programming and the reason to, you know, to sign with, you know, a company like, you know, Podshow or a number of other companies that do the similar thing is, you know, they'll provide, you know, the ad sales network that will get that can turn your productions profitable. You know, granted that, you know, hopefully, you know, you're creating something that a lot of people want to see, and, you know, anyone can create stuff. So there's a lot of competition out there. But, you know, one of the things that we decided we wanted to do is try to, you know, build our own sales force. And we again started kind of making it up as we went along. We went out and contacted people and told them, you know, what our shows were and what the viewership was and what the demographic was. At the same time, you
and when
know,
you say we, how many people were involved at this point where you're saying we?
I mean, Revision 3 started, you know, with myself, Kevin Rose, and probably about three other people, Jay Adelson, who's also involved with Dig, Dig.com. And so, you know, we sat down, and we even did the whole take a break and look at what you got and see what the elements are required to make it, how much it costs to make it, how much it costs if you're going to be doing something and you want it to be a full-time job for you or not, and to see if it's something that's really viable. You know, this is what it costs to make this. This is how we distribute it. This is how much it costs to distribute it. There's a little bit of there's some cost in distribution, not extensively. Once you reach a level of distribution that actually makes a financial impact on, you know, spending money on bandwidth, you know, you're probably to a level where you can probably have the viewership that you can deploy, you know, this whole ad sales thing and the sponsorship thing I was talking about. So
So what, at that point, when do you realize or when do you have a good level of viewership or audience? How do you define that? How do you guys define that?
Anyone? Well, I mean, luckily for us, with the show, one of our shows, most popular shows, is a show called Dignation. And, you know, the show is honestly two guys sitting on a couch drinking beer. And we set them up, we put the lights on, and we press the little red button on the camera. So, you know, the cost of that production isn't a lot. And right. So, you know, one of the things that you need to take into account is what it costs to do it. It didn't cost us really anything other than, you know, having some expertise in some video editing and knowing how to export
your
files to QuickTime.
Your time costs money.
And your time costs money.
That's
so,
key.
And beer,
and beer costs money.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Especially imported beer.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think it comes down to, you know, the fact that it really doesn't, in general, even with shows that are more complex than Dignation, as long as you're not trying to create the next, you know, Lost on you know, like ABC does, the cost of making shows doesn't cost a lot. So as long as you create something that has more than, you know, enough thousands of viewers that you can have a property that people want to reach your audience, then you've got something that's worthwhile from either an ad sales perspective or even a sales perspective. As long as you distribute something that's really popular, you know, you could create DVDs and sell that, because then enough people know about it and will, you know, buy it and pay back what you've put into it.
You don't even necessarily. I'm Robert Scoble, by the way, and I have the Scoble Show.
Where's that voice coming from? Okay.
You don't need an audience. I signed a six-figure deal with Seagate, who sponsors my show, before I even had an audience.
You didn't need an audience.
But well, I had a promise.
But you said I'm Robert Scoble.
But you have to deliver
audience.
On that audience.
You are
don't
known.
You?
You're a rock star.
Yeah. I'd like
you're
to jump in on here.
Let's ask the ninja.
Robert, yeah.
He signed a $300,000 deal.
Well, the thing is, if you have a blog or you come from a company where people know who you are, then you know, of course, you can go somewhere and you know, use your own notoriety, as a proof of concept right there, and probably break the deal that you did with Seagate.
But wait, don't you have to deliver on that audience, even though you're Robert Scoble? You don't. It doesn't matter.
You should see the contract. It's real simple. It says we sponsor your show for 3 months.
I'd like to address something about
in return, which is really great.
I'd like to address something about Scoble Show because I think that out of all of the networks and all of the people that are asking these big questions, like how do you do it. I think so far the idea of like that Scoble has of where you've got Seagate is the one, right? By having an individual sponsor like that, say fund your show for 3 months or 6 months or whatever the term is probably compared to like advertising or pre-rolls or even post-rolls or whatever, I would bet that that's probably the most advantageous for the content producer, for the sponsor, and for the audience altogether that I've seen so far in terms. I mean, there's different. It's sort of like the way that I've always divided this business conversation is into two levels. There's the level of sustaining and just being happy with what you got. You know, it's like, I like to produce my show, I can do it, and I don't need to have a mansion and all that kind of stuff, or I don't need to keep going like that. I'm happy just to do my thing. And then there's the other category of like, wow, I can see the potential behind this, you know, because you can look at TV and see all the money there and realize the difference in the production costs and everything. And so while I don't exactly think that sponsorship or advertising is the best way to go in this sort of lower level, or I mean, it can still work just fine in like an example of your sponsorship could, but in the upper level, the reason why I think this is the best case scenario so far is that it gives Scoble and his audience a chance to really, really be effective for Seagate in a way. Instead of just saying, here we are, you know, please visit our sponsor, or instead of saying, instead of not having conviction about it, that amount of time that you have with one sponsor allows you to really get close with them and understand and be effective, but at the same time it allows you the opportunity to go out and pick just one that really fits your interests. I mean, like, you probably loved Seagate or really did like them before you signed the deal and were happy to have them, you know, or you probably liked them a lot more and began to like them more and more as the conversation opened up. But nonetheless, I think that's a really, really good model for people, so that, like, let's say for instance you don't have a production company, but you're ready to make this step and you're ready to make a substantial amount of money with your niche show. It would be, instead of trying to say, oh, I've got to go do all of this stuff and get VC and blah, 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 or set up everything, if you could start a relationship with a single sponsor and that one, you know, put all your efforts into that one thing, then you might be able to, I don't know, I think that's a good idea.
Well, are we talking here then more about personality and celebrity? Because Scoble's pretty well known in the, you know, in this industry, and so that you think that... Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's a blog called Freshtopia.net, yeah. And they do a lot of stuff on you know, green sustainability and raw food, which is something that no other video blogger was doing when they started, and they got really big really fast because they had such an interesting topic that they were covering, and they got known for that really quickly because they were the only ones, and no one had, I'd never heard of them before because they weren't blogging before, and all of a sudden, in 3 months, they had deals with like three different places because they had, you know, they're like us, they do the production out of their bedroom, and you know, it was just like they got known so fast.
Well, that's a good
know?
Question. I mean, when we do our show and it's targeted to a specific audience,
right.
And so that if you're the first one there, kind of like, and people want to come to you because they want to reach that audience, creating a show, did you guys think of your audience first, or did you think of the idea first? Doug, you're like, oh yeah, you know, Ken, you got together and like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to do like, you know, or yeah, did you think about?
We thought of ourselves first. It was just things that were making us laugh, and it was also, you know, I mean, it came from frustration over banging our head against traditional media, you know, as well, and just realizing that we could do it ourselves. So it really was just out of us wanting to create ourselves and us wanting to have that control. But I do think there's a scalability in terms of the in terms of sponsorship, and I think it each instance is going to take a little bit of exploration and a little bit of like just seeing what's out there, and especially while you're building your audience, and until you get to the point where you're ready to pull the trigger on something and go with one sponsor or go with an ad sales company or build your own ad sales force, of just saying you can do it. You can explore. There's plenty of sites out there that will sell ads for you. From Google is a company that sells ads, apparently. But you know, from anything, from like the couple cents to like a little, you know, to Rever, whatever it is that you want to do, explore. But as you explore, just keep the dialogue open with your peers. And also with your audience.
Right.
Well, Zadi, yeah. I just want to ask you a question.
Okay.
I mean, you guys thought of your audience first, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you were interested in, like, doing production for teenagers and, children shows.
Not children, but teenagers.
Not children, but teenagers.
Young adults.
I'm like, children shows. So, I mean, were you thinking of the format of your show first, or were you thinking of
your
audience?
You know, it's funny. I think we kind of went into it thinking of audience first, and I think that we're kind of kids ourselves and teens, and I just like, you know, my brother and sister are really big influences. He's, you know, my brother's 19, my sister's 15, and so I get a lot of what, you know, what's cool, what's happening out there just from talking to them. And I just think it's fun, and I did think about, oh, well, there, you know, there's a lot that can be done. So it's always interesting to me, like, do people go into it from a business standpoint thinking, like, well, there's an audience that needs to be served that isn't being served, and so that you come into it advantageous?
That's or what
do
you guys kind of saw.
Well,
we're like teenagers. There's no...
Yeah, and I'm wondering, actually, from a network standpoint,
I personally think we're at an interesting juncture right now, because you know, one of the reasons that, you know, Revision 3 was able to have a certain level of success with its programming is because, you know, the more technology oriented geeks, and that's what our program is. Those are the people that were more inclined to watch shows on a computer or via broadband, and that's changing right now very rapidly. This whole thing called convergence, you know, the right now, for the most part, it's a lean-forward experience. And, you know, in the next couple of years, in the next few years, it's going to be more of a lean-back experience. And there's going to be, you know, more and more people that aren't necessarily those technically inclined. They're going to be able to watch stuff. And so when you're talking about, you know, think about your audience. You know, right now, right this very minute, if you created a show about a specific type of flower, you might not be able to find a large enough audience. Maybe you can. In a few years from now, the people that are interested in that specific type of flower, they're probably going to be able to access and enjoy watching that show, where right now they're not able or willing or knowledgeable enough to sit there at their computer and look it up and find it.
Right. So let's see, where are we in time? We have 5:40. Actually, 20 minutes of Q&A would be really cool, because I'd like to, you know, we'd like to hear from you guys and see if there's a back and forth here. Because, you can come up to that mic if you have questions, and then we can take it from there.
Well, thanks for all your hard work so far. I just wanted to say that whether you add commercials or not, I'll forgive you for that, but I want to hope that you inspect any contracts in the future to see if they're going to ask you to make the volume in the commercial higher than the rest of the program. That I will not forgive you for.
Like contract publishing kind of model?
Has anybody asked you to do that before? Like they're asking to put commercials in and make the volume higher? Like TV, that's the most obnoxious thing that TV does.
Yeah. They ask all the time. They're always asking for 5 more seconds. And you know, we
push
have...
Push back.
Yeah, we have our line in the sand of just in terms of just a straight percentage to say you can't run a 30 seconds of advertisements to get 3 minutes of content. I mean, that just the proportion is insane. And so, Yeah, we have our line in the sand.
By the way, Doug Kay is building a system that will actually automatically level all the little bits that come in. So if somebody gives me an ad, it will level it down to the same as my content.
What do you mean level it down? I just want to be clear on that.
We already built a thing called Levelator, which is free for podcasters, for audio podcasters. And you just drag your audio files onto Levelator, and it makes the levels the same.
Gotcha.
But he's doing that for video. He's coming out with a video system for video advertising.
With regard to sponsorships and with regard to even industry, I mean, it's an interesting thing in that, you know, a recent story with us is that we were able to get a really cool new sponsor in IBM, and they're served by a very, very traditional large company that does ad buys called Ogilvy. And, you know, they get so much money from IBM, and IBM says, hey, we want to reach this large of an audience and spend this, and we're willing to spend this much money to do it. And so, you know, they came to us, and they said, hey, we're interested in this new campaign we have, and, you know, we want you to run these 30-second spots. And we were actually, fortunately, we had an audience that they were really interested in reaching enough that we were able to negotiate with them and say, hey, this is how we do our advertising spots. This is why we think it's effective and why we think it'll work. And it was really, really cool to be able to have that dialogue with them and have them actually even agree, like, hey, that's really neat. We want to reach your audience in the terms that you think is most effective, which is completely different from saying, hey, play our 30 seconds and turn the volume up. Because if we took their 30 seconds and turned the volume up, we probably would have ended up with a lot of fans, a lot of viewers that just probably thought negatively about IBM.
Yeah.
This will be a little bit more technical oriented. You know, not too long ago, their only options were, you know, do I make this a QuickTime file, a Windows media file? Is it going to be
downloadable? Now you make all of them.
Right.
Every single one you can think of.
And now you've got all these different media players. You've got Brightcove, iTunes. You know, the Juice guys are getting interviewed in Time magazine. Do you see, like, one of these kind of coming, kind of breaking through everything else? Like, we'll all be
That's
doing
a whole
one
other
thing,
panel.
You think?
That's like another 2 hours.
Right.
But, about that.
But seriously, if you create a show and there's enough people that want to watch your show on a given device or in a certain way, then it makes it worth it to create it in that format. If there's a new, you know, if there's a new device that gets made, and enough people buy it, and they really want to be able to watch your video on their device, then you're going to make a version that works on that device.
And the idea there is that basically you finally have to say, even though if I think QuickTime is better, some people just love WMV and they love the, you know, their skin player, and they just feel more comfortable watching it there. Some people, you know, like 3GPs better than MOVs anyway, or something. Or you know, there's just all the that sort of. One thing that's really interesting that people miss a lot is that people like to get it in different ways, and that we should allow them to continue to be able to do that because it's just more comfortable. It's sort of like your house.
And then you always have to use like Ogg Vorbis and Theo to keep the open source community happy.
Absolutely. I think the most, I mean, we encode our show in 9 different formats, and by far what we've been surprised at is that our 3GP downloads are so much by far more downloaded than any of, and I don't know, I think a lot of that has to do with our demographics. So we kind of think of like, well, you know, if a lot of our people are watching our show on 3GP and on their phones and mobile, what does that mean exactly, and how do we communicate with them, and is that different from, you know, somebody watching it on the computer or somebody watching it, you know, through their iPod or somebody watching it, I don't know, like where, I think where you watch it is something that we personally think of. I'm not sure if anybody else on this panel has thought about like what the different types of formats, where you actually watch it, how it affects what you're making.
I think Ken does 2 formats.
Ken does 2.
3.
Flash and QuickTime.
Flash and QuickTime.
My question has to do with the number of views that your video blog gets and how that correlates to whether a sponsor or an advertiser starts to pay attention. In other words, what's the threshold? You know, up to a certain point, you know, they're not even going to look at it. When do they start paying attention? And then what kind of numbers do you really need to be getting into to when they actually will start to consider payment?
I think, oh, we all wanted to.
Go ahead.
I'll just keep it quick. I think it just depends on what you're making and who the person who's maybe going to pay you is. I mean, for us, we had like we had just started, and PodTech was like, we want stuff about sustainable culture, and you guys are doing it, so we want you. We had like 4 videos that we had made. That was my story, you know.
So honestly, if you have a niche topic, you can probably chase after the companies that serve that niche audience, like, say, for example, comic books. If you have an audience of just 5 or 6 or 7,000, you can probably go after the people that are interested to peddle it, you know, the people that are selling comic books even, and you can probably get them interested in what you're doing. If you want to go after a really large company like the GMs and all that kind of stuff, you're either going to go through a company such as, you know, Podshow or, you know, Federated Media, which I think was mentioned in the last panel. They act as an advertising agency where they can take your podcast or your show and lump it together with a whole slew of other shows to give you the number required to get those companies interested in spending the time, because they might not want to spend the money, the time and energy to sponsor a show with 5,000 people, but if your show of 5,000 people gets lumped in with, you know, 25 others, then all of a sudden you're over 100,000 people, and then it's worth their time. So that's one of the other ways you could do that. That, or you have to, you either have a show that has, you know, well north of 100,000, you use an ad agency that can serve your show along with other shows, or you have a really, really cool niche segment or niche topic where you can really target ads for the people that are interested, and it makes it worthwhile for those niche people to chase after your niche audience.
And are the sponsors or advertisers caring about the length of the show, or does that not, that's immaterial? It's just people coming to the site?
I think traditionally, in my opinion, again, traditionally, like, web video was considered to be like little 3-minute and 5-minute pieces, which it still is. But, you know, as this whole convergence happens, more and more programs are going to be formats that go from 5 minutes to over an hour. And if you have a program that's over an hour, but it's engaging and it keeps the audience, then people watch the whole thing through. So you basically, you know, you're going to create something that the audience wants to see. If you're creating it and it's 25 minutes long and it should be 5, then make it 5.
Are there any personal hard numbers that you guys felt that, yeah, this is, I've reached the time where I can definitely go now to talk to sponsors or advertisers?
And I know we just kept going out and doing our own thing and trying to figure it out for ourselves until someone came to us with what we wanted.
That whole idea of the incoming, I think, mm-hmm. once you get to a certain point, in fact, even still today, and this is my Uber sentence on business in this field and sort of, you got this? I believe that, especially in this day and age or whatever, in this field, that the very number one best way to take a show to success and to make it to a financial success is to make just focus on the show and make it as good as you possibly can. And if you can just really put your energies into making a really damn good show that can somehow stick out within its audience, you know, wherever those people are, if you can create the best one or one of the best ones there, then that's it. And that as a result of just doing that one thing, now I don't know in 5 years from now how this is going to work, but I just think right now while it's wide open still and, you know, there's plenty of room for everybody, if you just make a damn good one, the incoming will start coming in. I mean, even still with Rocket Boom, even with all of this conversation about all of the business, most of our conversations are, how do we make the show better? You know, this weekend I'm the most excited I've been in months. You know, we're about to, we've created a whole dig-like system within our video blog. We've transferred CMS and everything, and now each of the story links you can click to vote to see which one is the best, and we have threaded comments, and you can log in and have profiles and all that kind of stuff. And the reason why is because Rocket Boom's got like a lot of people come and they like to comment on it and stuff, but it's still just so limited, you know, from all the conversations that each day spawns. And so, you know, even still though, I'm thinking about, well, how do I set up all of the business and get all the other shows launched as we're doing all of this stuff? It's still my number one thought. How can I make Rocket Boom better? It's got to keep getting better and better. And the next show that I do, I don't even care about all this business stuff. I just want to make it good, and I think then they will come.
Has any of you thought or even tried a subscription model? And if so, do you think you would lose your audience if you were to charge for your content? Mm.
This is another thing that we're about to try. And my experience, or the thing that I always talk about, is Jason Kottke last year had done a little thing where he asked everybody to do micro donations. And then he wound up getting about $35,000 or something like that for the year. I can't remember the exact number. And I believe, in fact, that you actually hit on the head of where I wish this was all going, and that it wasn't all about advertising and sponsorship, but that the beauty of Web 2.0 that nobody's demonstrated yet is how to leverage the audience in that micro way into your... In other words, if our audience is so absolutely active and they're so willing and so, you know, forthright with everything, there should be a micro way, especially because, I mean, when you've got so many people, you know, per day, then the more people you get, again, with that micro scenario, the more it builds up. So we're about to try this. We're just going to try it, but... where people would actually be able to come and just leave a $5 thing or $7 or whatever they want to type in, but then also to channel them into these areas where maybe they would pay $4.50 per month over 12 months or something. Or if you were a business and you wanted to pay $1,000 for a day, then we would put your logo somewhere to where it kind of looks like a sponsorship thing, but it's more of just sort of like a, here's what you get, click here, and then we just sort of insert it very easily. But it's... the whole idea is it's more of like a PBS-style model where we really want to see, and again, I think this would be the success story if somebody could do it.
I see David nodding his head. He's like, yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm just thinking, like, I think Zay is doing it pretty successfully, yeah. And I think...
And you guys are also, right?
It's very non-offensive. The way that he's doing it, and that's actually pretty encouraging. And I don't find the red versus blue model offensive at all. I think it's because they just do the one thing for the year, and it gets you a little bit earlier. Cool Kids Club, and it's fun.
And you guys do that with Dignation, right?
So when you're talking about subscription and using that to generate revenue, when Revision 3 was new, we said, hey, we're this little struggling production company. If you like what we're doing, help support us and donate. And we said, hey, you can, subscribe the way, like PBS, you can do the $5 a month level or the such and such dollar a month level. And so we did that early on with Revision 3. And then as the company got bigger, we thought, well, we can't just like, hey, donate to us. So we said, well, what can we give back? What kind of incentives can we provide? And so like the only thing we do right now is we say, if you subscribe to be a paid member of Revision 3, we'll give you, certain shows as early releases. And, so far, we've been able to actually, maintain enough of a revenue off of that we keep doing it. And so...
But you can't sustain off that, I'll
bet. We can't sustain off that, but we generate enough that we are thinking, let's see if we can offer more and more and more incentive to do that and see if it makes a significant impact on membership. And I kind of think there's a good chance it will.
I think it takes a lot of experimentation and testing and trying to do it just right, but... It's the most beautiful way to happen.
It's
just giving a little tiny bit.
Right. It's also incentives. And so you're not prohibiting people from watching a show unless they pay. It's like you're giving back for what they're giving you. So I think that having that spirit infused in that, I think that promotes.
That's clearly the kind of thing too, where if you look at those two category things again, it's going to make you sort of. Like, even in the best-case scenario, it's hard to see how you could, have a mansion and a Rolls Royce and do everything with compared to the money that you could make with ad sales on CPMs per person. But, if I do believe even for a lot of people, there'll be a way to continue to progress, not just simply sustain with that kind of a...
Hi. I'm starting an internet TV network. And what we want to do is create original programming for college conscious audiences, so people that care about the world, basically. But my question is, how do you separate kind of your personal ambitions with conceptualizing your audience? Because for me, I just want to create Star Trek spoofs and try to audition for Star Trek 11. but at the same time, be putting something out there that's meaningful to an audience. So like, how do you reconcile creating something that's art for yourself, but something that will ultimately make a profit for you?
it's a question between art and design. Art is fine art, which, you know, you, it's up to you to decide to do whatever you want, and as soon as you bring somebody else into it, it's a design issue where you...
Yeah, I think it's all, like, it's a fusion almost. Like, I don't know that any of us really have created something that we don't want to create. I think it's like either there's an element of that we're really passionate about, and so that spurs us into kind of like, yeah, and makes those ideas grow. I don't know that anybody here, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing sketch comedy and improv for years offline for audiences of 50 people, and then joining up with Kent Nichols allowed me to now do that for hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, it's just keeping your eye on your art, and never losing focus on the fact that, like, oh, this is what I'm doing because I'm passionate about this.
So you have to put your focus on one or the other, whether or not.
Yeah, yeah, and but just...
I think a lot of people come into this because they you know, a lot of people that are into that are in mainstream media, they're like, they want to produce a show, they want to produce some sort of network that they can't, so that the barrier of entry is really low here, so you have the tools, you have the capability, and so that you're going to work on something you're passionate about as opposed to something that, you know, it's like, oh, well, I know this could probably make a lot of money, but because you probably get tired of it after a while. You just, you know, it's not going to be interesting to you. So if you're going to be in it, you're going to probably want to be in it for the long haul. And so, I mean, that's kind of
the advice. But also on that same note, don't be afraid to try something and fail at it.
Oh, I mean, hell no,
Just because there's so much space, like, that doesn't work.
Yeah. But, you know, definitely. There's room for error, right?
Yeah.
Plenty. Thank you. Although I've never made a mistake.
Hi.
Hello, Kenyatta.
Cool. Hey, I have a short answer question, okay? Speaking of mainstream media, you all produce very high-quality yet very low-cost content. And then somebody said something before about convergence, and, you know, you have Apple TV coming, so eventually people are going to be getting their, like, really expensively produced crap on, you know, through the same network that you're using. Talking about production companies 2.0, maybe this is 2.5 or 3.0, do any of you have any ambition to kind of, like, follow that route and, like, become the Jerry Bruckheimer of...
Secretly.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see Casey and Rudy and from Galactic has to.
And is that something that you had? It's two-part. That's part one. And part two is this an ambition that you had before you got into video blogging or whatever?
No and yes. Those are my answers. No, I do not want to be super high production. And yes, I did want to do this before I was video blogging.
And my answer would be yes and yes.
Don't be ashamed of that, Zadie.
Yes and yes. I want to keep getting my production value higher and higher, you know, especially as the tools become more affordable, you know, and easier to use. I want to keep pushing that with whatever technology gives me. I'm going to push it as far as I can go with it.
And I want to make a point also with what you're doing, Ryan. I mean, you're also, we were talking in the green room about, you know, you're doing stuff with India and, like, other countries. So, you know, this is a whole other panel about kind of, like, the globalization of production companies, because it's not brick and mortar. It's like you're online, they're different languages, they're different, you know, legal issues, they're different. I mean, there's a lot of
other
stuff.
As far as, like, production value, I remember when we first started video blogging and people were like, video blogs are so crappy, you know, they look bad. I started with a little camera, I didn't have a microphone, whatever, and I slowly saved up money and got, you know, a nicer camera, and, you know, you do those kinds of things if you need to. You don't always have to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm all about cheap, you know, doing stuff on the cheap, doing stuff with your camera phone, doing stuff with your Canon PowerShot. So it's like, yeah, you get to a level where you might want to be super high quality HD, you know. Like, I'm getting to that point where you start noticing what you need for your production. But when you start out, it's like, hey, I have this video camera, I'm going to do this thing.
Sometimes
we were getting compliments on our production value, and it was Kent's wall he painted green.
Right, exactly.
And the video camera, the tape deck didn't even work on the video camera. So, I mean, it was just like a broke-ass camera.
You use what you have.
An old Mac, you know, and the people are like, great.
Yeah. But what was the second part? The people do get expensive. That's true. If the production production value
gets
more expensive,
robots.
There's more expectation. hard, I know.
Another thing that's interesting too, that, that to kind of address that a little bit, is that I think the first thing I said was that Rocket Boom, I've always found my solutions a lot in blogging, and that blogging's really informed my direction and everything else. And one of the things that's the most popular for popular bloggers is that they use their blog as like a loss leader for their business, where they say, I'm not going to make any money or put any ads on this, but I get a book deal, I get production and this and that. And so I think that in this sphere, those external opportunities actually have a very high value. Like you can, you know, I'm an authority to go create a co-production or to give very high dollar consulting or, you know, all kinds of things, so that those auxiliary things can also really, really add up and sustain as well, sustain you as well.
And they're also growing pains, because when you're doing this by yourself, and like Kanata was saying, you do get to that stage where you want to produce more high quality work, and people see that and they want to get involved. It you do kind of start losing money, because if you're hiring people and you're dealing with contracts and you're dealing with, like, you know, issues of like liability, and it's like it becomes really scary really fast. And so it's like, oh, you start need to getting people to help you out, and so that there is that kind of like you feel those bones kind of stretching, but I think that's only part of the process.
Yeah, the one big thing was like for us was to increase the amount of bandwidth that Ken had to spend on new projects. We hired on, you know, an editor to help us out on some of it, but we had established a style and could work with them, and it ended up to be an ultimately tremendously liberating thing, because it really just opened up a lots of time and lots of brain bandwidth.
Yep. Yeah. We have one more.
This might apply to all of you, but it's directed towards Andrew Rockboom. When you said you were by yourself creating this content, and then you had to find somebody to help you bring in and work the business end of it, did you deal with partnerships, or how did you handle the business at that point, and who owned the content?
In terms of for Rocket Boom, you mean?
Yeah.
I've still never gotten into business with anybody where I've had to like give up any equity or anything like that. I think that that would come, you know, usually in like a venture capital scenario, or maybe a little bit in an angel scenario.
So everybody you bring in is like a contractor or an employee?
Yeah, but you know, you can also get around all these things too. Like, let's say you don't want to give up equity, but you could still give somebody a licensing deal for 75 years. Or, you know, there's all kinds of ways to relook at the value. Or within your business, you could maintain 100% equity, control equity, but you could give away 100% monetary equity or something. So, and then, you know, depending on how you structure it, that's what I've been learning over the last 6 months, is like how to define all these different things. But that's a whole nother pool of being creative too. I think that, you know, you can do the standard procedure. I'm going to go get angel funding. I'm going to put in pre-rolls. I got this and that. And then I'm going to have venture capital. And then we'll flip the company in 36 months. Or you could say, you know, how could we be more creative? And with the business as well. And so that's the one thing that I've actually have enjoyed, even though I don't know business at all. Like, I've been coming up with all these really radical ideas that business people are going for. So it's been nice, and it fits in, you know, it's because it fits in with our, it's all informed by the show itself. It's just amazing, like, the answers are already there, it's just a matter of discovering them, I think, based on the particular scenario.
So I think that's the end. If anybody has any questions, do you guys want to say any final words before we kind of wrap up here? Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you so much.